Welcome to the Wisdom Circle. To subscribe or follow us on your favorite podcast platforms, please visit us at www.thewisdomcircle.com.
We are happy to have you. I am happy to be here with my friend and colleague of 40-something years, Tony Ponturo. We are enjoying doing multiple episodes. We hope you're enjoying watching or listening to them. By the way, you can subscribe to the Wisdom Circle on any platform that you might watch or listen to us on. So we hope you'll do that and spread the word. Tony, how are you?
I am good. I was just looking up the other day. Our first podcast was May 15th, so we're knocking on the 1 year. Well, I guess we have a few months, but time has flown, and so it's. I think, you know, we called it the Wisdom Circle, hoping we were imparting wisdom to others, but we may have learned more than our listeners and viewers, which is good, because that's
right.
The purpose.
No, absolutely. We're all learning. You know, it's funny. I knew we started in May. I'm glad you looked up the date, because, you know, obviously we need party hats and champagne. But no, time does fly, and I don't think we've missed an episode, so we've been consistently out there for those who want to teach us or learn something. So yeah, it's amazing.
Well, they sort of say in business, when people stop calling you, then you know you're done. So I guess when guests start saying, no, I really don't want to go on the Wisdom Circle, we'll know we're done. But so far, so good.
Yeah, let me check my calendar and get back to you on that. So a word about our guest today is Jeff Lindor. I met Jeff for the first time at your college at our kind of opening day ceremonies. He gave a really inspiring speech. He's created an amazing company. I'll do a little bit more on that when we're bringing him on, but very excited that this all came together. And I thought we'd talk a little bit about, you know, busy weekend, Saturday Night Live 50th, the All-Star formats are all different. I think we could do SNL first and then the All-Star formats together. We'll talk a little bit about what's going on in the workplace amongst our younger folks who are in the job market for the first time or for a short time. So, Tony, SNL.
Well, you know, as you probably know, I've told everyone that actually worked the first Saturday Night Live. As an NBC page, and no one really knew what was going to happen. No one knew. And if you watch the movie, I mean, it was going down to the wire as to whether they had the rerun of The Tonight Show ready to go, if in fact the dress rehearsal, based on the opinion of the NBC executives, was, you know, a bomb, if you will. But obviously it went on, and 50 years later is still going. So, but one of the things that triggers off of that is I was reading an article actually this morning where the original expectation of NBC was 20 million viewers. It only did 8. But what they started to talk about is, and I've heard this from friends down here, is people now know that it's going to be sort of on Peacock forever, right? So people have said, well, I don't have to tune in from 8 to 11 Eastern on Sunday. I can wait and watch it on Peacock, which I did for the concert one Friday night. I didn't watch it live. I watched it 2 days later. So it's going to be interesting from an advertiser standpoint. Us as consumers are like, great, I missed it on Sunday. I can watch it on Tuesday. But advertiser expectations are going to have to start being measured, which is, well, I bought 20 million viewers. You know how the salespeople go. Well, you're going to get 20 million viewers, but I only got 8. So, you know, so how are we going to get to 20? Are you going to give me bonus units on Peacock? What are you going to do? So I'll throw that to you, being one of the super salesmen.
Well, good things take a while. We're going to get you to 20 million, but probably not in a week. So it depends how it was sold, right? Like, it was, if their expectation was 20 million live on Sunday night, that's a problem because flights end and people have other creative and all that other stuff. So I'm sure there's a whole bunch of stuff we used to do, negotiations going on those who can take it over the long term, maybe get a little bit extra for doing that. Thank you for your patience. Here's some extra stuff. And for those, I'm like, yeah, that's nice, but I got to be done by the end of February or March. Yeah, they're going to have to figure it out now. But I don't think we have to worry about having, like, you know, a charity dinner for the Saturday Night Live business at NBC. It's probably as profitable as any, you know, the morning shows are super profitable. And they pay the hosts way a lot of money. SNL, they're barely paying the kids anything because they're just trying to get onto television and be stars and get a movie or a show. So, yeah, I think they'll be okay. I think they'll be okay.
Yeah, yeah, it's the ultimate sort of internship, I guess, which in an NBC page was for these comedians who then get exposed and it goes from there. And, of course, you know, Broadway Video, which is actually Lorne Michaels' right. production company, produces it. So now we all know how the repeats work and you can go to YouTube and watch it. And so all those residuals, right. you know, keep churning in. So, it's a great part of culture. You know, I think generally it was well received. You know, people could always say, oh, why didn't you show this or show that, or that skit wasn't as funny as that. But I think it was well. Leading into that, we were talking offline that the NBA All-Star Game had, like, I think its second lowest rating ever. Well, they actually competed against each other. So here goes the live choice of Saturday Night Live, although you'll see it in repeat. NBA All-Star Game Live probably doesn't have that much appeal on repeat, right. especially under its new format. So competition created maybe a drain on
the All-Star Game, and then we'll try to get to the Gen Z in the next few minutes. The one thing I was going to say about this, the one person who could care less about the 20 versus 8 is Lorne Michaels. He's just, somebody else will have to deal with that. So let's step on to the NHL NBA format platform. So, boy, two different worlds, right? The NHL seems to have, like, reinvented the All-Star break with the four nations. And the NBA seems to have lost their way with this kind of semi-competition comedy show. Interesting to see what happens. I mean, what were your thoughts? I was, really excited about the NHL. I'm not a hockey fan, but that was pretty cool, especially there. There's a Ruzioni from 1980 gold medal team out there, and you know, other things going on in the world about in the U.S. and Canada. I was kind of semi-rooting for Canada.
Well, you know, a little anecdote, which is going back a little bit in history, but Dick Ebersol, as you know, is the head of NBC Sports for a long time, and he started to use non-sports programming in the Olympics, and the ratings went down. And he was appealing to women, but the male, who wanted sporting events, said, "Well, you're not really talking to me." And he learned a lesson, which he admitted. I think the NBA, who's made the All-Star game more a entertainment show, the hardcore fan, sports fan is saying, well, I'm not really seeing sports, or I'm not seeing competition that's intriguing me, so I'm out. The NHL, and no one really thought this would, the Four Nations would be as effective as it is. But as you and I have talked, I think we both think, and we probably use different terminology, is to me, sports is tribal. It's local, it's national. You've World got Cup. USA, Canada, Finland, Sweden on your jersey. And that becomes a real rooting interest. And to their credit, the players took it really serious. So it became, maybe some people said it was better hockey than sometimes a regular season NHL game. So they focused on, let's be a sporting event, whereas the NBA said, let's have Kevin Hart stand up in between the
conversation. If the format slowed down betting. Like, I don't know what the bet lines were or what the betting was on the NBA thing. And people say, you know, I'm only watching this thing because I bet something. And, like, I don't know how hard or easy it was to bet. So I'll look into that and get back to you. So you had an interesting comment this morning in our early morning texts about the workplace and Gen Z group who are not lasting as long, it seems, in their jobs, as you know, we all clung to our jobs because we were in that corporate ladder, and the folks here have lots of platforms, and they all kind of think more horizontally to take care of each other, and life is not just about work. But talk a little bit about what you read and what you're thinking about, why that is.
Yeah, I mean, I read that, I'm going to say a third, I think it was even a little bit more, of Gen Zs that have been hired in a job after 6 months, they're actually let go. It doesn't really say why they're let go. We can surmise that there's either a level of expectation from the Gen Z that they have in their own mind what a work day pattern is. They came out of, most of them, the COVID situation, working at home. Now many of them are being told to come back to work in the office. But they also, not to steal Jeff's thunder at all, but they have a lot bombarding them. They've been given a lot of reins by their parents. And then they get into a workforce and someone's putting some restrictor plates, using a NASCAR term, on them. And they're like, well, wait a minute. No one's ever put a restrictor plate on me. That doesn't feel comfortable. And then, I know if I was the boss, maybe a little old school, I'd say, here's what I'm going to pay you. I expect certain things. And if that's uncomfortable for you, thank you very much. I'll find somebody else. Maybe a little cold, but at least that. But I think that's what bosses are starting to do.
Well,
you just can't take the money.
This is a good segue to bring Jeff on, because I think that he'll have a different perspective, as we know, because we spoke to him for a couple of seconds before we got on the air. But I think that's the tension in the workplace. It's the old school managers and the young school kids coming through, and the generations haven't flipped to the point where the young school kids are the CEO, senior managers. Let's bring Jeff in and get his opinion. So, really excited to have Jeff Lindor. Jeff is the founder and CEO of The Gentleman's Factory. He has an entrepreneurial spirit and love that. And he has built a business really dedicated to empowering men of color globally, focused in New York City, but helping them build networks, help groups, contacts, and more that we'll find out. But I just think it is such a great thought, especially the fact that the company was founded 8 years ago, 2016, meaning that Jeff did it long before there were conversations about things that are now more politically charged, DEI and all that stuff. This was about helping communities and helping, you know, people of color. Jeff told a great story about his youth and questions he asked when he would just walk around being a young Black man in New York City. So, without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Jeff Lindor. We're happy to have you. We're excited to hear more about, you know, what you've built, what your past was, how you got to the build. We always like to talk about the journey. Tony Ponturo, my partner, our co-host, along with you and me, is ready to ask some really hard, not really, questions. But anyway. Jeff, tell us a little bit about, how you got here and how things are going, and a little bit more about the business. Just really interested.
Well, Ray and Tony, it's such an honor. I'm a huge fan, and it's a huge privilege to have me on, you know, to be on the platform with you guys. So thank you so much for having me.
Great.
I was born in Haiti, raised in Brooklyn, Coney Island, Brooklyn, in a housing development. And I was just really just curious about why does like my community look the way that it does, and why are we resource deprived but have so much ambition, so many dreams, and want to also participate in this world as well, but we just didn't have the access needed to really, you know, get to a place of self-sufficiency. That's how like my life was shaped, right? Of just that question of why and how and what could be done. That's where I started my, career trajectory. So I started out in banking, then I did a brief stint in healthcare on the marketing side. And then I got a master's in public policy, where I learned community, right? And from there, like I worked in high level city government to really just see how I could really help and benefit New Yorkers. Then, you know, in all my career of trajectories, you know, in positions, I just saw that I was isolated as a person of color, where saying, oh, like, why aren't there a lot of people who look like me in these rooms or in these decision-making, you know, positions? And, you know, going back to the question of why and what could be done and the isolation, particularly among Black men. So that's why I, you know, started Gentleman's Factory to really solve this isolation.
That's interesting. I would love to know, so, and Tony, I promise not to overwhelm the conversation with Jeff. I sometimes do that.
That's okay. I'm not bashful.
Barge through bigger doors than this one. No, like, so it's a leap of faith, right? When you, and I love that you were just always asking why. You talked about that in your speech at York, which, by the way, if I didn't say it already, Jeff and I are York College alum. I got the bear over the shoulder. Trying to get York to reopen a store where you can go buy things and take them home and wear them, which we don't have right now, but that's for another day. But I'd love to hear how you got to York and to college, frankly, and through college and then to master's. I think that's really exciting. But then there's the point where you're in city government, you're helping the community, but then you say, you know, this just, I just don't feel like I'm getting it done to my own level of satisfaction. I'm going to go do like something that's a total risk. So can you talk a little bit about that journey from, like, let's say, you know, high school to I'm leaving city government, a little bit more specifically? You kind of gave it back, but.
Yeah, totally. So, yeah, so high school, I wasn't prepared for college. I was not. And I'm relatively tall. I'm like 6'3", 6'4", on a good day, depending on the weather, right? And like from that, like I always just very was just, you know, and like I played basketball, right? So like I was on a basketball team. You know, I played for Grady High School back in the days. And at that time, Grady High School was regarded as a very, you know, like had a really great basketball program. Some of the, you know, teammates that I played AAU basketball in went straight to the NBA from high school, right? So that wasn't me, right? You know, and I was lazy on defense, and I just wasn't consistent enough. I have a 14-year-old son who's in the AAU circuit, so I'm, you know, all of the things that I didn't do, I'm just saying, hey, sir, like, in order for that level, you actually need to, like, run and wake up early.
All the things a 14-year-old does not want to do.
You know, have nutrition, etc. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, so then, you know, I just was not prepared for college. So then that's when, you know, thank God for CUNY, you know, so I then eventually went to York College, where they fully embraced me, you know. It was a really great institution, particularly, well, especially where I was at that time, you know. It really gave me the foundation needed to, you know, propel into the world, right? And I always had a really great network of people who I can call upon to ask for questions, advice, you know, counsel. And that's how I always really had great jobs, right? I started out, again, in banking at JP Morgan. And then I, you know, did healthcare. And I was on the marketing team during the Obamacare, like the, you know, Affordable Care Act. Like, I worked for Emblem Health, for those who are in the city. I was like their brand and strategy manager, one of the best jobs ever, where I was a corporate sponsor, right? So we wanted to, you know, educate the community on the exchange, the Affordable Care Act. And Emblem just merged with HIP and GHI. So they just did a joint venture. They merged, so they rebranded into Emblem Health. So no one at the time really knew the brand. So, you know, we had millions of dollars to disperse throughout New York City and beyond for marketing, sponsorships, et cetera. You know, we even did a deal with Barclays Center when Barclays first opened. We had the Emblem Health exit. I think it was like Dean Street exit, what we call the Emblem Health Way. So all of those really cool, fun things, while also, you know, educating the community on health and wellness. But what was so interesting, though, at that time was we were looking to, you know, also market to Black men, right, in New York City. And we were saying, oh, like, where are the physical spaces that they go so that we can have a sales rep there or so that we could do a lot of workshops, et cetera. And there's a lot of fantastic organizations, but they just didn't have, like, physical spaces to justify, you know, giving, you know, $25,000 to for a marketing deal or $50,000 at that, right? That was outside of, like, a physical, right. like a one-time event, right? Like, we liked long-term partners. So then, you know, there weren't spaces readily available in New York City for what we were looking for. So then I said, oh, wow, like, if I have a large budget that I could deploy capital to really, you know, market to this specific demographic, and there wasn't spaces for that in New York City, then they don't have spaces anywhere, right? So then, you know, that's what, like, led me to start even considering about, like, building spaces particularly designed for men of color.
Yeah. Yeah, Jeff, you know, I think Ray and I both feel, and think, I know we feel this is sort of important ground that you're, you know, sort of plowing, if you will, that as a person, because I think what we all want is, and I'll be curious with your gentleman's club, how you're advising these men, is that you don't want corporations to hire, you know, but then it's window candy. It's not really good to move the process through. I think we all dream of a day where everything's just totally integrated. Everyone's a person. We move through on our experience and our effectiveness and whatever. I guess that's an ideal world. I got not in trouble, but when I was at Columbia, I was interjecting into a class with people of color, both black and woman. And what I was trying to do is encourage them to do things that will affect change, which is what I think you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And, I sort of said, you know, there's been things like protests and marches going all the way back. But in some respects, we're sort of back where we started, you know, and particularly under a current environment. So do things that will really affect change. They took it as I was somehow criticizing the past and not sensitive to someone like, you know, being in your shoes. But what I was really trying to do is pump them up to really make the world a better place. So as that is a preamble, and you don't have to agree with anything I just said, how do you look at it? And when you have your members, what is it you're trying to impart and encourage and motivate to them?
Yeah. Well, just a number of things, right? One, we just really want to navigate, participate, and succeed in this world like everyone else, right? You know, we have been systematically ostracized by certain opportunities. So, you know, what we do is we look to partner with institutions, or we look to, you know, educate our members and to say, oh, okay, like, you know, this is where the world is trending, right? These are the new industries that are opening up. These are the investment opportunities, right? So, you know, going back to isolation, where you go into, let's just say, corporate America, you don't see a lot of us together in a sense, right? So then it's like, oh, like, you know, there is like this pride of, I remember when I was in corporate or just in certain spaces where I would see someone who looks like me, and there's just like a certain pride and a certain energy that I have of representation. But then I said, oh, like, you know, how about finding all of the isolated individuals and bringing them together so that we could, you know, solve some of the challenges within our community, or start having conversations or talking about, or, you know, speaking with others in terms of how do we just build collectively, right? So I think that the notion and where the country is today, DEI and things of that sort, yeah, like, I look at it as, you know, everybody wants the same thing, right? You know,
yeah,
for their family, right? They want to go home at the end of the day, right? Like, they want to be safe. They want opportunities, right? So you know, if everybody wants that, then we should want that too, right? So so that's what we really say is like, how do we work together to accomplish the goals that everybody else wants?
Part two of this podcast will be available next week. For more information, please visit us at www.thewisdomcircle.com. Thank you.